Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We check in with local officials regularly on this program. Today, we venture a little farther afield and meet with three members of the Mecklenburg County House delegation to the General Assembly. Republicans have been in charge there for a while now, but in the last election lost their supermajority, canceling their ability to automatically override gubernatorial vetoes. But that doesn't mean they aren't exercising their muscle. Stalemates seem to be the order of the day when it comes to the budget for this fiscal year, Medicaid expansion, even gun legislation. So this hour, we get the perspectives of Representatives Kelly Alexander, John Autry, and Christy Clark. Christy Clark represents District 98. She is less than a year into her first term in Raleigh. How's it been?
Well, you know what? I think being in the legislature is one of the best things I've ever done in my life. I went to my first Judiciary Committee meeting in January and walked out and said, man, I'm in my wheelhouse.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, the legislature is a fun, crazy, weird, unpredictable place. But getting to advocate on behalf of North Carolinians is the best thing that I could ever ask for.
If the legislature is in your wheelhouse, what did you do prior to being in the legislature?
Prior to being in the legislature, I was a paralegal. I worked in corporate and intellectual property law, and then I was also an advocate for gun law reform.
So it's everything you've expected and more.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. John Autry represents District 100 and has served two terms in the legislature. What are you doing there? You're a video editor.
I'm trying to edit legislation at every opportunity and take those skills to that realm. But Representative Clark's absolutely right. It's the most frustrating, humbling, rewarding, gratifying experience that you could ever expect.
Wow, that's an unexpected description from both of you, but I'm glad to hear it. So welcome back to the program. And Kelly Alexander is an old-timer representing District 107. He spent 6.5 years, if I'm not mistaken, in the House. Good to see you again.
Glad to be here.
Are you on the same page with these guys? You're obviously enjoying it. You've been back several times, right?
It's a challenge.
Okay. All three of our guests today are Democrats. We are not ignoring Republicans. The voters of Mecklenburg are, at least when it comes to the House. All 12 members of the Mecklenburg County House delegation are Democrats. All but one member of the entire delegation, including the Senate in the legislature, are Democrats. Only Dan Bishop is a Republican, and he's running for Congress, as we all know. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at charlottetalks, and you can watch us on Facebook Live. So Republicans held firm control of the legislature for about nearly a decade, I guess, until the last midterms when they lost their supermajority. Kelly and John, you've experienced both realities since your time in office. How have things changed, if at all, since the supermajority was lost? Kelly Alexander.
The biggest thing is the Republicans at this juncture can't just railroad legislation through, can't ignore the governor's position, and increasingly can't ignore the things that Democrats are concerned about.
Same for you?
I'd say that's the same thing, yeah. Okay. They're, you know, some days you have to look around and say, now, they don't have a supermajority any longer, but they still try to act less like they do.
Now that Republicans can no longer preemptively override the governor's veto of legislation he doesn't like, has it changed the dynamic anyway? You just said, John, that they sometimes walk around like they have forgotten that they don't have the supermajority, which is probably a smart thing to do. I mean, if they have forgotten it, maybe you will too. In other words, but do Democrats today have more input on legislation before it goes to a vote because of the reality of a lack of supermajority, or are Republicans simply willing to wait for the governor to reject legislation and then compromise with Democrats?
I think it depends on the issue. We've just seen, for instance, in the Farm Bill, Democratic opposition to certain elements of that bill actually got listened to at the committee level, and a very interesting fight broke out between the proponents of the bill from the Senate side mm-hmm. and the proponents from the House side. And you had in open debate an airing of those differences. And as a result, a bill that normally would have just gone, you know, zip right through, slowed down and has had to be reworked several times. And at this juncture, we really don't know what it actually is going to look like as it moves to the floor.
Hmm. One thing is certain, the change in the balance of power has resulted in stalemates, just like that, on many different fronts. And we can start with the budget. I know you're going to answer. I know how you're going to answer this question because you're all Democrats. But legislatures are supposed to deliberate and negotiate and compromise. Which side is the more intransigent?
Anybody want to take that?
I'll just share an anecdote a lobbyist with lots of experience in that building told me one day when I was lamenting about my frustration of mm-hmm. trying to have some positive impact on our judicial system, you know. He shook his head in agreement. He says, you know, John, I've been working up here 16, 17 years, and if you close your eyes, you can't tell who's in charge.
Okay. Has it always been this way? You've only been in the legislature for 6.5 years, but when you talk to some old-timers who were there when the Democrats were in charge, wasn't it the same way, just on the other side? Weren't the Republicans complaining about you being immovable objects?
I arrived at the end of Democratic control in okay. the middle of 2008. And, yeah, you would hear those kinds of complaints from the Republican side. Mm. What's happened, I think, more than anything else, though, is as the Republicans gained control, there was an attempt to redress what some of them believed to have been historic problems going all the way back almost 100 years.
Well, that's how long you were in control, just about.
But what you...
They wanted to reverse 100 years of Democratic leadership.
And they tried in about four. Doesn't work well. And you know, again, part of the problem, I think, when we look at this, is that we sometimes forget that folk who are currently conservative Republicans at one point were conservative Democrats. Hmm. And some of this back and forth used to take place inside of the Democratic Party as opposed to between parties. And so that some of the policies that were generated that now Republicans look back and say, you know, you did us wrong, were essentially policies that had they been in control, they would have produced themselves.
From a newcomer's point of view, Christy, what does it all feel like to you? I mean, obviously, you knew what you were getting into, and you knew that Republicans were in charge. And when you won the election, that balance of power remained. So what has it been like? How frustrating has it seemed to you?
You know, we brought in 18 new Democratic freshmen this year, and I'm quite certain the majority party had no idea what to do with us. We're all well-educated and outspoken. We have principals and lawyers and paralegals and pastors and people of all walks of life who really are passionate and informed on the issues, and they really don't know what to do with us. So we help hold back some of the legislation when it gets off the rails, and we also help push forward better legislation.
What does that mean, they don't know what to do with you? They don't know what to make of you, or they really don't know how to use you? Explain that.
Yeah, they don't know what to make of us because in the past, you know, there's never been such a large group of Democratic freshmen moving in since they've taken power, of course.
I see.
And so they have not been used to our vocal, you know, voices about different issues and different things, and we aren't afraid to stand up on the House floor and speak or speak up in committee, and you know hasn't been the case always in the past.
So we're going to start by talking about the budget, and the budget, we're I think a little about 6 or 7 weeks into the fiscal year, and still no budget for the fiscal year has been passed. So listen to Governor Cooper's perception of what's been happening or not happening with regard to passing the budget.
I put a compromise proposal on the table. I made a compromise on school vouchers. In my original budget, cut them out altogether. my compromise said we will allow the people who have them to continue to use them, except no new ones. But, you know, I've done things with this compromise that I don't really like, but I understand that negotiation is honest give and take, and we've heard no response to any of this.
So the governor started talking in that clip about his proposal for teacher pay raises, which is about 5% higher than what the Republican legislature has proposed. We'll talk about that later. But then he went on to talk about the budget in general. Is his a fair description of what he and you, the other Democrats in the legislature, have been up against?
Yes. There's no question about it. He put the compromise on the table, and rather than having a response to it, what has been happening is they've been holding us hostage. On the House side, the Speaker controls when certain things come up. Mm-hmm. And so on our printed agenda has been a veto override. And what we have to do is show up, be in our seats, and be prepared to sustain the governor's veto, because he can pull that vote at any time just out of the clear blue sky now.
And meaning that if all the Democrats aren't there, they will win.
Basically, yeah. That's it.
That's what you mean by being held hostage? He could spring this vote at any – he could
at
look around
time.
The chamber and see, enough Democrats are not here that we can hold this vote now.
Right.
Yep.
And
the Democrats did the same thing when they were in control?
No, not at all.
All right.
This stems from Tom Tillis and the invention of the veto garage, where legislation, the veto comes in, the Speaker parks it and holds it to pull out whenever he wants to.
Okay.
And this is a continuation of the Tillis veto garage concept.
Well, here is the point of view of House Speaker Tim Moore on all of this.
We didn't create this crisis. We did what every legislature heretofore has done. We have passed a budget that funds the priorities of the state, that gives teachers a pay raise, that gives state employees a pay raise, that puts badly needed money into capital projects around this state to keep this state moving forward. It is the governor who has brought up one single issue and is holding the entire state budget hostage over
the
one issue.
The hostage word again. So you're each being held hostage by the other. He's referring, of course, there to the expansion of Medicaid. As much as you support the expansion of Medicaid as Democrats, is he wrong? Christy.
You know, I don't think he is wrong, because before a budget even was prepared, you know, Governor Cooper and his team came to the table and said, let us help develop this budget together. Let's have a compromise budget right from the get-go. And that's not what happened. The budget was done behind closed doors, and there was no input from anyone on our side of the aisle until it came to committee. And even the committee that I was in, I didn't see the part of the bill, capital appropriations, until 5 minutes before the meeting, and I think the meeting lasted 10 minutes. It was an up or down vote, no amendments, no input from anyone in the room on what was in that part of the bill. So, you know, when that happens, it doesn't mean that we're holding them hostage. It means they weren't willing to come to the table right from the start.
But Democrats have wanted this Medicaid expansion since the beginning of Obamacare, because it's part of Obamacare, and the Republicans have been against it in large part, I guess, because it's part of Obamacare. When we come back, we'll talk about whether or not that really is holding the legislature hostage. This is your first opportunity to have any leverage at all on this issue, and you are using it. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHG. I'm Mike Collins. Kelly Alexander is with us, representing District 107 for 6.5 years, Democrat. All three of our guests are Democrats because the entire Mecklenburg County House delegation is Democratic. John Autry is representing District 100. for the past 2 years he's been doing that, and Christy Clark in District 98. This is her first year in the legislature, and we're checking up on things in the legislature today. The major sticking point that we've been talking about is the expansion of Medicaid. That's your leverage. That's what you're using. It's the first time you've had a chance to do it. You described this idea of Tim Moore taking the role and deciding when he's going to have this veto override vote based on when not enough Democrats are there. Aren't you doing the same thing on the other side? We're not going to say yes to the budget until you say yes to Medicaid.
Well, it's being mischaracterized. More is going on than Medicaid. I mean, for instance, there's a bill that we've been discussing as recently as last week that would pump essentially $20 million into a rural hospital that's losing about $6 million a year. And we estimate, incidentally, that if we had Medicaid expansion, that hospital and others like it would pick up as much as $2 million in revenue, at least reducing that gap. So there are a lot of moving parts in all of this. And it's on the other side, it's easy for them to characterize all of this as only Medicaid, and it's the only thing that's holding it up because it creates a wonderful soundbite.
Well, Tim Moore has said there will be no action on HB 655, which is the Medicaid expansion bill, until the budget is passed into law. And then they'll come back. Yeah, I think he's volunteered a special session, if I'm not mistaken, to come back and talk about Medicaid once you say yes to the budget. Is this a matter of who will blink first, John Autry?
I think it's a matter of trust. And to say that we'll come back and we'll fix this Medicaid expansion issue on its own and to itself, I'm still waiting for the legislature to replace the loss of revenue for the municipalities when they repealed the business privilege license tax. So the story then was, we'll pass this now and then we'll come back next session and fix it.
And they didn't.
And it's still way out, not fixed.
Was that their intent, do you think, or is it simply other business has gotten in the way?
I don't think any other business would have to get in the way and could preclude any kind of action on anything they want to take up.
You know, we see the stalemates. That's what we see from afar, from the 30,000-foot level. We see the legislature passing the budget, the governor rejecting the budget. We see no movement on amending the budget. Are there negotiations going on behind the scenes that we don't see? Are things going back and forth between Tim Moore and Democrats, between Phil Berger and Democrats on the budget to make it work so that everybody can vote yes and move on?
I would hope that at some point you get the kind of talks that you have just described. The latest intelligence that I have says that as of right now, it's nothing substantive has happened. And I think that is the classic textbook definition of gridlock. And that's what I believe citizens are very, very concerned about and really want to see change.
So what's going on up there? I think it costs us taxpayers $42,000 a day to have you in session.
That's low.
Okay, and you keep coming into session, and if nothing's going on, why are you there?
To make it legal to serve raw oysters on a half shell.
That's a piece of legislation that
they passed? That's a piece of legislation that has been passed during this
very
process.
Helpful. Thank you so much.
Glad I could help.
Well, I mean, last Monday evening, we came together, and it cost more than $50,000 for us to be there.
All right.
And we passed one piece of legislation. The following day, we passed one piece of legislation. So in 2 days, we burned through at least $100,000 of taxpayer money and did virtually nothing.
It takes longer to introduce the pages that are serving that week than it takes to dispose of the legislative business that we're conducting on a daily basis.
You actually mention their names in session? Is that what you do with the pages?
The opening session on Monday night, all the pages are introduced.
And they change every week?
They change every week.
Yeah. Oh, my. Can I go up and serve for a week?
Sure. Okay. There's an application process, and we'll have to make sure you qualify.
So unlike the federal government, when the federal government reaches an impasse on the budget, the government shuts down at some point. The state government does not do that, but surely something, there must be winners and losers in this process, are there?
Yeah, because when we don't make our deadline to adopt a budget, last biennium's budget continues in part. Money that is reoccurring moves forward. Non-reoccurring things don't. So that certain things that you might expect are going to happen that were funded by non-reoccurring money don't. And think of it as a shave and a haircut on what we were spending in the last biennium. But the needs of the state don't dial back.
Right.
They continue to move forward so that we will arrive at a situation that ultimately when a budget is passed, in order to help make some state employees whole, we'll have to make some of the adjustments, some of the raises that they were anticipating, retroactive in order for them to be whole.
Kelly Alexander is the man you just heard speaking. He represents District 107. He is the chair of the Mecklenburg County delegation, and I've been saying you've been serving for 6.5 years. You've served for 6.5 terms, so that's about 13 years. Is that correct?
That's about right.
About right. I've been wrong about John Autry, who represents District 100. He's been serving for 2 terms, not 2 years. Christy Clark, however, is in her first year and representing District 98. Let's go back to Medicaid. Republicans have been against expanding Medicaid since its inception in the Affordable Care Act. Part of the Affordable Care Act was going to help people in the donut hole, if I recall all this correctly, by expanding Medicaid in the states. And the federal government was going to pay for that expansion for a good period of time. And then at some point in time, the funding for that would revert back to the states. And when Pat McCrory was governor, and he was on this show several times when he was governor, he talked about why he was opposed to expanding Medicaid. He said that Medicaid in North Carolina was broken, costs were out of control, and we needed to fix it before he was willing to even entertain the idea of expanding it, because he said when the federal government's funding sunsetted, we have no idea what the costs will be. That was years ago. He hasn't been governor in several years, and that was early in his gubernatorial tenure. Has Medicare been fixed? Did it need to be fixed, in your opinion? And has there been any attempt to fix it? If not,
well, the problem with Medicaid, in terms of what we haven't done in North Carolina, is that the money that's generated in this state has been spent elsewhere because we haven't reached out and expanded Medicaid to help use some of our own money. The other thing is that in the interim, we came up with a proposal that essentially would have had the state share being paid for by the hospitals that were going to benefit from the expansion. And everybody pretty much agreed to it. Mm-hmm. Now, in the abstract, at some point in the future, the federal government may indeed change up its formula, and we may have to figure out, you know, how to deal differently as we move forward, but that is virtually true of every federal program that's out there.
But Obamacare is in the sights of the Trump administration, and it seems to me that if President Trump is reelected, he may have more than just a target to shoot at. He may actually end it, which means if the state commits to Medicaid expansion, won't they be up the creek without a paddle?
Well, you know, I have a lot of confidence in Secretary Cohen at the Department of Health and Human Services. She is innovative and intellectual, and if she's thrown a curveball, I know that she can help us come to a resolution on that. But what's really important about discussing Medicaid is the 500,000 North Carolinians that don't have health care right now. And so we are putting their lives on the line for the sake of a debate and future speculation that may or may not happen, and that's really just unacceptable.
But if was Pat McCrory and Phil Berger and Tim Moore, were they right about Medicare in North Carolina being broken at the cost of Medicaid, excuse me, I always get them confused, being broken in North Carolina and in dire need of costs getting under control before we could consider expanding it? But were they right about that?
That position of everything in government being broken, it's our responsibility to fix it. And if we don't fix it, then we should be held accountable for that. The problems with Medicaid, I think, are certainly have been addressed in the last 4 years. There have been a lot of innovation going on and a lot of upheaval in the process and the system. But I think having 400,000, 500,000, depending on what you look at in the number of people, and how Medicaid expansion would help these rural healthcare providers to recoup some of their uncompensated care mm-hmm. is worth the benefit. And the world we live in now makes that possible. And what happens in the future, we have to deal with that when the future comes.
And this gets back to what you were referring to, Kelly Alexander, because these people who don't have Medicaid and don't have insurance go to the emergency room.
Correct.
And they don't have the money to pay the emergency room costs in these rural hospitals and even in the urban hospitals. And so the hospitals and the state pick up the tab on this. This is cheaper? It's still coming from the state. How is this cheaper?
Well, the expansion is cheaper because the federal government is paying about 90% of the cost as it stands now.
Mm-hmm. But that's us. We all pay taxes to the federal government.
Ultimately, yes, it is us. But when you do not agree to expand, what you are saying is my tax dollars now will help the citizens of California, of Texas, of Minnesota.
But not me.
But not of North Carolina.
And if you're on Medicaid, you can see a physician and not go to the emergency room, which is less expensive.
Yes. And hospitals are pushing for preventative care, which ultimately is less expensive than waiting until you just absolutely have to have the maximum type of intervention to help you.
Are all the Democrats in the Mecklenburg delegation, are all the Democrats in the legislature on board with Medicaid expansion?
I haven't polled the caucus, but I would have to say that I am unaware of any strong opposition in this caucus.
Republicans would like a work requirement and premiums paid by people who will then become eligible for this Medicaid expansion. Where do most North Carolinians stand on that? Do you know?
Well, there is a Republican bill that embodies that, and that's their variant on quote-unquote Medicaid expansion, mm-hmm. though they don't exactly call it that.
It really isn't that based on right. what the Affordable Care Act calls for. It's not real Medicaid expansion.
Right. It's so far, it's the closest that they've come to saying, okay, we got to do something.
So there's a work requirement in their part of in their version
and a
of
premium.
This, meaning that you have to be employed to get Medicaid and the premium. And people have said, mostly Democrats, have said that when you look at states where they have done this, it doesn't work. It's more paperwork involved and more expensive to do it with the premiums.
In Arkansas, we have enough data now that shows that in Arkansas, where they have a work requirement and a premium requirement, the administering the verification of the work requirement cost the state over $5 million, and they recouped about $260,000.
Former State Senator Jeff Tart has written on our Facebook page, Medicaid expansion is unnecessary to provide health care insurance for the gap population. There is a better solution to access the 90% federal dollars to create a modified commercial plan from the health care insurance companies. All of that was Greek to me. Do you understand it? Maybe true. I just don't understand it.
I understand the boilerplate, which gets to kind of a philosophical difference about whether or not you want to expand Medicaid, which is essentially a governmental program, or you want to shift dollars into the private sector. And so, and there's an ongoing debate about which works best and which is necessary. And that's part of the problem, is that that open debate is stymied in the legislature at this juncture.
So the GOP opposition to this, I want you to read their minds. Is it out of concern for the state's finances, or is it because Medicaid expansion is connected to the Affordable Care Act, and it has been at least the national Republican policy to get rid of that as soon as possible?
It's the latter, not the former.
Okay. Another sticking point seems to be the Democrats' belief that the GOP budget compromise did not dedicate enough funds to public education funding or spending, including larger public school teacher pay raises, infrastructure, and environmental issues. The environment is one of your big issues, John. What's missing? What's wrong with the budget in that respect?
We're not doing anything in that budget that addresses climate change, the crisis that is facing this country and the world, and we're not doing anything about it.
What would you have us do?
I would
on
have
the state
us,
level?
I would have us put policy in place that makes reducing greenhouse gas being released into the atmosphere and moving the state's economy to a 100% fossil fuel-free grid as soon as possible, and the sooner the better. That is the way that we have to address this issue.
What's the cost of that? Who are the winners? Who are the losers?
The cost of that is much going to be a lot less today than it will be 10 years from now. Putting the policy in place, then we have the opportunity to actually take the measurements and look and see just where we can make strategic moves, because the longer we wait, the more expensive it will be and the more radical and drastic the measures that we have to accomplish.
I have 30 seconds. If we do it, but Virginia, South Carolina, Tennessee don't do it, Georgia doesn't do it, what then? We're just an outlier. What kind of impact can we really have? 20 seconds.
I think we have to take that step and lead by an example. And once we fall into that position and take that up, we will see the surrounding states have to fall in.
John Autry represents District 100. Christy Clark is here from District 98. Kelly Alexander from District 107. He's the chair of the Mecklenburg County Democratic Delegation to the General Assembly in the House. We'll come right back at Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The political world has its attention on the presidential race, but local elections coming up will have a bigger impact on the day-to-day lives of Charlottesians. Seven Democrats are on the ballot for city council at large in next month's primary. So join Charlotte Talks for a live forum with the candidates Wednesday, August 28th at 7 p.m. at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater. And send your questions for the candidates in advance to charlottetalks@wfae.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with three members of the Mecklenburg County delegation to the North Carolina House, Kelly Alexander, John Autry, and Christy Clark. Couple more questions about the budget before we move on to other things, and the budget's in stalemate at the moment. The governor has called for an 8.5%, I believe, increase for teacher pay raises. The budget, the Republican budget, allows for 3.8%. That's a big spread. But in light of recent pay raises that teachers have received in the past, is there room for negotiation among Democrats on this issue?
I think most Democrats support what the governor has brought forward because it's a better deal for teachers. You know, overall, the Republicans, on the other hand, when they tout how much has been done to increase teacher pay, tend to forget where we started and where the state had been historically in terms of progress vis-a-vis, you know, other states. So the governor's proposal will go a long way toward helping to restore where North Carolina has historically been, even though it won't get us back to where we need to be at.
What are the differences in the budget and what Democrats want to see in terms of state employee pay raises in general? Because the State Employees Association has come out in favor of the Republican proposal. Are they proposing more for state employees in general?
The governor's budget does.
Why are they supporting the Republican budget?
That's what we keep asking them.
Yeah, we'd like to know the answer to that, too.
Okay.
If you can help us.
Okay. Give me 15 minutes. All right?
White smoke from the chimney or something.
In talking about the budget impasse, Tim Moore, the Speaker of the House, told WFAE's Lisa Wharf that the Republican approach to funding has been to go through the budget and, quote, see if those are good practices and good use of state taxpayer dollars. And if you look at where a lot of the grants and investment went in terms of some of the projects, he said, it went to some of our rural areas in the state that really have seen some of the toughest times in recent years, end quote. No doubt that is true. But then over the weekend, the Charlotte Observer, we read that the widening of I-77 from Charlotte to South Carolina has been delayed until fiscal 2029. And the widening of Independence Boulevard from Idlewild to 485 won't start now till 2024 because NCDOT, who keeps laying off people who build roads, they don't have the money. Is this another instance of Raleigh ignoring the economic engine of the state?
Yes and no. And I'll say it that way because North Carolina Department of Transportation is a self-funding entity, pretty much.
They get their money from what?
Gas tax, primarily.
Okay. All right.
And so as long as the gas tax doesn't change, as long as we don't take into consideration electric vehicles,
You might want to do that.
There's a whole new universe that's developing out here, okay?
Yeah.
But our funding model is stuck somewhere, not quite in the horse and buggy era, but just a little bit beyond that. And so ultimately, we're going to have to deal with how we are funding roads, mass transit, all of that. And because that resource is decreasing, not increasing, and because climate change has been driving more and more money that has to be spent immediately to restore things, we are in a quandary.
Because electric car owners, although they don't pay the gas tax, they do pay extra fees that normal cars don't pay.
Right in front of us with this legislature right now. There's a contingency that wants to increase the amount that is charged to electric vehicles for their use. Mm-hmm. And that's where, you know, what Representative Alexander mentions about how the funding model is so antiquated. We should look at maybe charging people for vehicle miles traveled.
How would you keep track of that?
Cars get inspected every year, you know, and the odometers are checked, and that could be recorded that way. But the other point is that so many of our positions in government, for instance, in the Department of Public Instruction, the budget had the Republican budget from the House eliminated 44 positions in the department. And when asked about, well, why are that being removed, the answer was they have been vacant for 2 years and they can't fill them.
Right.
But the way the budget has been cutting back on all the services that the states provide is just compounded by the fact that in 2017, the Republican budget that was approved and they overrode the governor's veto of, provides corporations and the richest 1% tax cuts and tax breaks that amount to $1.7 billion by next year.
New York Times reports this morning that in states where Republicans have been in charge for a significant amount of time and Republicans like small government, and what happens in the states, not in the federal level, is that that's where the rubber hits the road in the states. And it turns out that people, when they discover that potholes aren't being filled because the states have cut back on services, when teachers can't get school supplies because states have cut back on the teacher budget, et cetera, they don't like it very much. So maybe from the Democrats' point of view, is this the catch-up? People are going to catch up to this at some point?
I always say that people don't really want to have to pay for the government they want anyway.
All right, let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about something that's on everybody's mind, particularly after the shootings in Dayton and El Paso a couple of weeks ago. There appears to be, although time passes, and as time passes, the movement kind of slows down, but there appears to be some movement in Congress toward passing some sort of meaningful or fair gun control legislation, with a lot of people being polled around the country. The majority of the people being polled want background checks. They That's want right. them. Even members of the NRA want them. The governor of Ohio was met with pushback recently as he tried to console citizens of Dayton who then chanted back at him, "Do something." And the chant was echoed in the General Assembly, our General Assembly, by New Hanover Democrat Deb Butler.
"We have heard the pleas of this nation, the chants of El Paso and Dayton to do something. They cry out, do something, do something, do something. It is time to do something. How long are we going to sit around? How long?"
Wow. There appears to be a mood shift underway, I think, around the country, maybe in our legislature. I don't know, because there are two gun bills that are stalled, and you are the primary sponsor, Christy, of both HB 86 and HB 454. What would those two bills do?
So House Bill 86 is a comprehensive gun safety bill that has several provisions that are shown by data to reduce gun violence, primarily closing the background check loophole in the sale of long guns. Mm-hmm. And then House Bill...
What is the loophole?
Currently in North Carolina, you have to have a purchase permit to buy a handgun, and that is not the case for long guns.
Why?
That is the law that has
Why?
Been set by previous General Assemblies. In 2013, the Republican Party did a comprehensive review of gun laws and loosed them quite a bit and overlooked long guns.
So, and H. Bill 86 would also restrict assault-style weapons, barring their sale to anyone under 21, as opposed to the current age of 18.
That's right. Currently, an 18-year-old can go to a gun show and buy an assault-type weapon or a rifle from an unlicensed seller with no background check and walk out the door with it on their shoulder and go do whatever they want to do.
Define assault weapon.
Well, you know, I'm not an expert in gun law or gun types of gun laws, but it's the type of gun law or gun type of gun that's been used in these mass shootings, and they are the ones that are deadly. You know, they have the most impact in killing people at a rapid rate, and those are the ones we want to keep out of the hands of people that shouldn't have them.
The other bill that you're the co-sponsor of is HB 454. That's the red flag bill.
Yes.
What does red flag mean?
So a red flag bill is a bill that would allow family or law enforcement to come before a judge and ask that firearms are temporarily removed from someone who's a danger to themselves or others. And then that person would have the opportunity to come back in the following days or a week or so to testify on their own behalf. And if they need assistance, they would be able to get that. And that means what we're looking at is talking about reducing suicides. Over half of gun violence in this country is suicide completed with a gun. And so we really want to focus on reducing that, and that bill would help with that.
Both of these bills have stalled in committee. Is there bipartisan opposition to this, or is it mostly coming from Republicans?
You know, the bills have stalled in the Judiciary Committee, and the chair of that committee has indicated that he didn't feel we had time to talk about those bills. So that was really...
Was this prior to Dayton and El Paso, this opinion that we don't have time?
Following Dayton and El Paso.
We don't have time?
Mm-hmm. So while we're sitting in Raleigh and being called in for the budget vote, there are days where we have no committee meetings. And, in fact, I'm on the Agriculture Committee, and we met... four times to talk about reinstating the Milk Commission. So during that, you know, time frame, we could have had the opportunity to debate these bills.
Kelly Alexander.
What she's not saying, because she's much too polite, is that the bills were introduced very early in the session, and that it is pure BS that they did not have time to discuss them. In fact, one of the reasons that these bills now are bubbling back to the fore is because we had to resort to a discharge petition, which is a procedure that's in the books that is not used very much, that requires 61 members to sign something that says we want this taken out of a committee and we want it to be reported directly to the floor. Mm-hmm. It enables immediate action. What is happening is that Democrats have signed on to the discharge petitions and Republicans have not. So at this juncture, I can say without any thought that anybody can object to it, is that the Republicans are standing as rocks in the road to meaningful discussion and a meaningful vote on these issues, which are being demanded by our citizens.
You said, Kelly, you wrote a post on Facebook that our citizens want constructive action and they want it now.
Right.
How do you know that?
Polls. The last two polls showed that the issues in Christie's bills are polling very high. 70% and 80% of the citizens of North Carolina are in favor of these common sense measures.
Why don't Republicans want them then? Because they're hearing the same thing from their. This is bipartisan support in national polls conducted. I think the latest one was conducted by NBC News. In national polls, bipartisan support, overwhelming bipartisan support for gun control legislation.
But forget national polls for a minute. I'm talking about polls of North Carolinians.
Right.
So why
are they being ignored? Why are the constituent desires being ignored by Republicans? If that's the case,
Mike, I wish I knew. It doesn't make any sense to us.
You know, how much NRA money goes to fund campaigns in North Carolina's legislature?
I haven't got a dime. I don't know.
Well, you know,
there's a reason for that.
Yeah,
they don't call me.
Senator Burr and Tillis were in the top 10 recipients of donations from the NRA.
They're not in the legislature.
Yeah,
they're
but
in the
it
US
shows
Senate.
You what's happening there. And then, of course, in the General Assembly. The NRA lobbyist is there almost every single day, and then the homegrown version of the NRA, Grassroots North Carolina, they're pretty aggressive.
There's another bill stuck, evidently, HB 842. It would require the registration of all assault-style weapons and would mandate the reporting of lost firearms. That's not the case now. If you lose your gun, you don't have to report it as lost.
If it's stolen out of your vehicle or your home, you do not have to report that firearm was taken from you.
The last time you were here, Kelly Alexander, we spent a lot of time talking about hemp legislation, and evidently that's still an issue. And you were here a couple of years ago to talk about hemp. It's a versatile crop. In some ways, it's the answer to our tobacco farmers' plight as the demand for tobacco has been declining. Hemp, I understand, sells for $800 a pound. CBD oil, which is derived from hemp, it comes in at $40 a pound. What progress has been made toward making hemp a legal crop in North Carolina?
Well, it is a legal crop.
Okay.
The federal farm bill passed, and it made it legal. What's happening in North Carolina right now is a move to make smokable hemp, which is about 25% of sales, illegal.
What's in smokable hemp? Is there THC or CBD? What's in it?
0.03% THC, which is the federal definition of hemp.
Okay, so is the opposition because of the possibility of getting high, or is the opposition just on smoking anything in general?
You would have to smoke a carload of hemp in order to get lung congestion.
So why the opposition?
Essentially because
emotion.
Emotion. And law enforcement can't tell the difference between hemp, smokable hemp, a legal product, and marijuana, which is at this juncture not legal.
So I know you favor legalization of marijuana. Would that just solve all of this?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Would you join the...
I take no position. Kelly Alexander, District 107, the chair of the Mecklenburg County delegation to the House of Representatives in the state of North Carolina. John Autry represents District 100, and Christy Clark represents District 98. We hope this is the first of a series of visits with people from the legislature. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.